Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Music Review. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program features a guest, Annie Collins, an award-winning film editor from New Zealand, who will be reading the classical music article today, and then will join us in a discussion about the uses of music in filmmaking. Welcome, Annie.
Thanks very much, Randy. Great to be here.
Music Review is underwritten by Bill McClure, tuning pianos in the Raleigh area since 1968. For more information or to schedule a piano tuning appointment, please call 919-779-1755. This program is designed to provide the latest coverage of classical, jazz, country, rock, and pop music news. But first, these musical trivia questions. Today's trivia questions come to us from the website onthisday.com. Question number one. It was on this very day back in 1959 that Dolly Parton's very first single was released. What was the title of that song? Was it A, 9 to 5, B, Puppy Love, C, Coat of Many Colors, or D, Jolene? Dolly Parton's first single. What was its title anyway? And question number two, the Beatles and the Rolling Stones met for the very first time today at the Crawdaddy Club in Richmond, England. Which band opened that show? Was it A, the Stones, B, the Beatles, C, neither one, they both followed after Herman's Hermits, or D, they both appeared together as the opening act for that show? So which band opened at their very first meeting show anyway? The answers to these two important trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. Our transitions come to us from that same website, onthisday.com, and today, quote-unquote, is the weekend of April the 19th. Well, it was on this very day back in 1899 that composer Randall Thompson, no relation, was born. Randall Thompson was best known for his chorale, Alleluia. Born today in New York City, 1899. And it was 47 years ago today, 1977, that Annie opened on Broadway. Congratulations, Annie, on your Broadway opening.
Thanks, Randy, again. No relation, however.
Okay. Well, actually, that was the musical show, Annie, that opened on Broadway today, back in 1977. Demkiri Te Kanawa introduces our classical music news. It's entitled Smoke Inhalation and Lots of Vodka, soprano Demkiri Te Kanawa on Working with Leonard Bernstein. This is written by Kyle McDonald on the 1st of March, 2024, ClassicFM.com.
Few opera singers are as beloved as Demkiri Te Kanawa, who rose to extraordinary fame in the 1970s and 80s with sensational performances of Mozart, Strauss, and Puccini at London's Covent Garden. As she celebrates her 80th birthday, Dame Kitty is in conversation with a fellow singer and good friend, Classic FM presenter Ailid Jones. Ailid and Dame Kitty speak about how they both have sung for the great American composer, Leonard Bernstein. For Kitty, it was in 1984 for a major new recording of Bernstein's 1961 musical West Side Story with Spanish tenor José Carreras and the composer himself at the podium. The soprano shared that she always dreamed of being Maria from when she was a little girl. She says, "I saw the film and I loved it, and there I was with the great master himself." Dame Kitty recalled those days in New York spent with the famously chain-smoking composer. "We did West Side Story, and that was quite an experience, as he smoked through the whole thing," she said. "It drove me mad, all that cigarette smoke. I said, 'You're going to have to stop. I'm dying of smoke inhalation.' And he sort of did. He was very nice to me, very kind." Ah, then the vodka. Oh dear, yes, lots of vodka. "He was quite a master. You know, he's like Mozart. He was creating beautiful music, and we loved being there with him. We didn't want him to be upset or anything. He was just too special." Born in Gisborne on the east coast of New Zealand in 1944, Dame Kitty told Aylard of her simple childhood, with few material things. She did not see her television until she was 17. Her mother identified her remarkable singing voice early and encouraged her to perform and develop her talent. The soprano's first public performances came on local radio stations. Dame Kitty shared her very personal view of her career in opera and classical music, from her arrival in London as an unknown New Zealand singer to the sensation she created as the Countess in Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro at the Royal Opera House in 1971. Over the years that followed, Dame Kitty worked with almost all the great singers and conductors of the second half of the 20th century. She recalled many of the personal connections and friendships with fellow singers and conductors Sir Colin Davis and Sir George Scholte, whom she affectionately termed the Hungarian Mafia. Dame Kitty ended her conversation with Ailey by talking about the work the Kitty Te Kanawa Foundation she established in 2003, which supports young New Zealand singers making the journey to the opera stages of Europe, just as she did in the 1960s. "I discovered that so many young people have no finance going to England, so we would give scholarships to young students," she said. "The foundation also delivers financial support, mentoring and career guidance, and has supported dozens of New Zealand singers." She spoke with pride of a new generation of New Zealand singers at Covent Garden in Glyndebourne. How will Dame Kitty be celebrating her 80th birthday? She says, "I know there's a very nice invitation by our Governor General for several of my friends and colleagues and our foundation sponsors to have a cocktail party at Government House," she reveals. "And that would feel a very appropriate way for a living legend of music to celebrate."
Dame Kitty Te Kanawa of New Zealand. As noted by Dr. Julia Jones in her 2019 book, The Music Diet, music activates almost every region of the brain, and as it's essentially a vibration, it triggers responses between brain cells via the ears and skin almost immediately. It's those responses that professionals in the industry seek when considering the use of music in film. Our today's guest, Annie Collins, is an award-winning film editor whose career spans 50 years, covering documentary and drama, encompassing iconic New Zealand films. She worked 4-plus years as part of the editing team on Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings, and her last drama feature premiered at the Sundance Film Festival. On behalf of NCRS, welcome to Music Review, Annie.
Thank you so much, Randy. It's lovely to be here again.
Now that is beautiful. I really like that.
It is. I agree with you, Randy. It's one of the most beautiful film themes that's ever been orchestrated. And people don't really know just how chaotic things can be as you are working through a film before you even get to the point where music is laid on it.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels like something like the Schindler's List theme that everybody knows really well,
mm-hmm.
sort of happens, just happens, and then all of a sudden it's there and it's on the film and you cannot imagine any other music at all being there.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it takes quite a long process, mm-hmm. and it can follow many different paths before you get to that point.
Mm-hmm. So I do wonder what the editor's role is in producing such a memorable product. I know you have to work with the composer and also with the director. That must be somewhat of a balancing act, a delicate negotiation process.
It's really about relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And it is delicate.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, I may not know who the composer is when I start editing.
Oh.
A drama film or a documentary.
Uh-huh.
And there comes a point in the film, and it's quite a long way through the film, and that's the point at which music starts to become sometimes necessary,
mm-hmm.
whether it's drama or doco.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, I'm go to the director will be with me generally, and I'll say, "So who have we got?" And they'll say a name, and I'll go, "Oh, good." And if I don't say, "Oh, good," generally they'll go, "What's your feeling?"
Uh-huh.
And I'll give them whatever feeling I have from having worked with the footage.
Interesting.
Over weeks and months to get to that point.
Right.
I've worked with the footage, and I've been crafting it and leaving space mm-hmm. for music, because although I don't know who the composer will be, I don't know quite often what the director has in their head,
mm-hmm.
I will actually be hearing music in my head.
Interesting. So the actual composer's role seems to come fairly late in the whole process. You must be using something, though, for replacement of what the music is?
Yes, we often do. We call it temp music.
Ah, temp.
And temp music is both a blessing and a curse. And you'll find that many editors actually have a big library of film soundtracks, which don't actually consist of a whole bunch of songs or a whole bunch of lovely tunes.
Mm-hmm.
What they'll consist of is background tonal tracks which give you the emotion mm-hmm. that you're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
And so an editor will go to that bank of available music
mm-hmm.
and they'll put that in. It's not music that we can actually use because it's under copyright, but it will give both the film
mm-hmm.
and the composer, when they begin, the sense of what sort of tone we want to happen
mm-hmm.
at that particular part of the film.
Mm-hmm.
The curse of it is that you're actually cutting to that music, and you follow the music or the tones, cadences, its rhythms, its pace, the way it changes tone. And when the actual music comes in later,
mm-hmm.
the pictures often don't quite fit.
Oh, I wondered about that.
Yes.
Wow.
So I take, generally I take the tracks that come in from the composer,
uh-huh.
and I'll be sitting there at my bench fitting them to where the composer says that they belong.
Uh-huh.
And often I'm going, oh, I don't think so. I'll just start this 5 seconds earlier,
uh-huh,
or five, you know, two seconds later, or even 10 frames later.
Hmm.
And that sometimes I'm having to recut.
Oh my gosh.
The pictures, okay, in order to just hit the spots in the music that the composer has provided.
Interesting. I noticed you had mentioned somewhat of a chaotic kind of situation that exists that is actually good, though, for the entire process, right? When does that occur? And
chaos starts right at the beginning.
Chaos starts. Well, there you are, stuck with all of this footage that you have to sift through.
Yep.
I know,
yep,
that must be chaotic.
That's the first bunch of chaos. Right.
But there's a point in time that's reached where all of a sudden it starts emerging, right? It starts speaking to you, I think you said.
You hope.
You hope, okay. And sometimes, yeah, that's not till late in the process, I guess.
Well, it depends on the film. Every, uh-huh, film is different.
Oh.
There is no rule about, mm-hmm, how you cut a film, and there's no rule, mm-hmm, about the music,
uh-huh,
that goes on it, or when the music is composed,
mm-hmm,
in fact.
Mm-hmm.
And you said before that the composer comes in quite late in the piece.
Uh-huh.
Normally they do.
Uh-huh.
However, it doesn't have to be that way.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the Greek director, Yorgos Lanthimos,
mm-hmm,
in his film Poor Things,
uh-huh,
had his composer, and that was the first film that he's used a composer for, he had his composer compose all the music before they shot.
Oh. Hmm.
So they had access to that music,
uh-huh,
on set,
uh-huh,
if they wished. His next film, he will use a composer again, but he has stated that the composer is not to see the script,
mm-hmm,
is not to see any footage.
Hmm.
And he's given him 3 words to compose to.
Hmm.
And the words are basement, bees, and space.
Hmm.
And I don't know how on earth a composer works with that.
Uh-huh.
But that's how it's going to happen.
Right. And I guess it also raises the whole question of what exactly is music anyway. Because it can consist, I think, as you referred to in your answer there, about spaces as well, pauses as well, which becomes part of the soundtrack.
Yes.
And even sound effects, I guess, can also be, yeah, music.
Yes. And again, I'll reference a very recent film.
Uh-huh.
It's The Zone of Interest.
Oh, yeah. Just outside Auschwitz, the family, yes.
Yes, okay. Yes, that's right.
Uh-huh.
And it's set in this beautiful garden,
uh-huh,
which is outside the wall of Auschwitz, mm-hmm, where the commandant and his family,
mm-hmm,
live their lives as if nothing is going on across this big wall.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you never go inside the, mm-hmm, camp itself. You never see anything in there, nothing nasty.
Mm-hmm.
But right through the film, there is this, I hesitate to call it music,
mm-hmm,
but there is a soundtrack,
mm-hmm,
compiled of rifle shots,
mm,
shouts,
mm-hmm,
screams,
mm,
conversations, shouted conversations going on. And it's all in the surround,
mm,
speakers. So this is quietly happening right through the film.
Mm.
And I call that a music track.
Yeah.
Mm. And it's hard to call it music.
Right.
But that's the purpose that it's fulfilling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, you had just finished up a documentary, didn't you, before coming here on this trip around the world. What's, mm, the status on that?
It's now being finished right as we speak,
uh-huh,
in New Zealand. They will probably be in the sound mix. They're getting it ready for the New Zealand International Film Festival in July. And the interesting thing about the music on that film, and this I look for in documentary whenever I can, and that is I'm looking for any music that is actually shot on location at the time. And in this particular case, the film is, the documentary is set in Papua New Guinea with many family groups, and they have a tradition of singing welcomes to people, singing the history of how they met those people. And I had about five or six of those beautiful songs available to me just in the shot footage. And those I used, and those start the film and they finish the film. They're coming out of those people in that place. There is a composer who's composed music for it as well, but the intro and the outro, that's the people themselves. And I love to be able to do that. One of the things that I'm always aware of, especially with film, it's a creative business. We mentioned chaos right at the front, and for me it's like the three C's. There's chaos, and you need the chaos in order to have creativity. If you just go with what you've always done, you'll always get what you've always got. It stops the creativity. You actually have to disrupt what's in place in order to create something new. And sometimes that disruption will occur way at the end of a film. We could be in the music mix, and we're there, and suddenly the director will say, we need to take out that music. We need to take out that sound. We need to leave this sitting just in its own sound. Or we need to take that music out. We need silence here. And you have to have courage to do that. Creativity requires courage. And when I see that in a film, that's when I love a film.
Well, thank you again, Annie, for sharing your expertise and insights with us. Have any final thoughts?
I was just thinking about, back to Kiri Te Kanawa. When we're dealing with film, and especially with music with film, there are two things I think about. One is breathing, and the other is making it sing.
Okay. Well, thank you once again. That's beautiful. So how did you do on today's trivia questions? Well, the answer to our first question, it was on this very day, back in 1959, that Dolly Parton's very first single was released. What was the title of that song? Was it A, 9 to 5, B, Puppy Love, C, Coat of Many Colors, or D, Jolene? Correct answer, answer B, Puppy Love. As noted in DollyParton.com, Dolly Parton released her very first single, Puppy Love, at age 13 on Gold Band Records. Puppy Love, written by Dolly at age 11, along with her uncle Bill Owens, was released by Gold Band Records in April of 1959. The lyrics showcase Dolly's ability, even at a young age, to write relatable songs. By the way, Circle Access .com adds, here are five songs you probably didn't even know were written by Dolly Parton. One, I Will Always Love You. That was the Whitney Houston hit. Number two, Put It Off Until Tomorrow by Bill Phillips. Number three, Rainbow Land. That was the hit by Miley Cyrus. Number four, Kentucky Gambler for Merle Haggard. And number five, Tina Turner's hit, There'll Always Be Music. And the answer to our second question, the Beatles and the Stones met for the very first time today at the Crawdaddy Club in Richmond, England. Which of those two bands opened that show? Was it A, the Stones, B, the Beatles, C, neither, since they were both after Herman's Hermits, or was it D, they both appeared together as the opening act for that show? Correct answer? Answer A, the Rolling Stones. The year was 1963 when the Beatles met the Stones for the very first time at the Crawdaddy Club in Richmond, England. The Rolling Stones opened that show. As noted in a 13 April 2023 article published in VermilionCountyFirst.com, it was 61 years ago today, April 14, 1963, that the Beatles and the Stones first met. The Beatles, who were new on the scene in London, had heard about the group through word of mouth and were in the audience at the Stones show in Richmond at the Crawdaddy Club at Station Hotel. In 1988, when Mick Jagger inducted the Beatles into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, he recalled first laying eyes on the group while on stage, remembering, "We were playing a little club in Richmond, and I saw right in front of me, there they were, the Fab Four. The four-headed monster. They never went anywhere alone. And they had on the most beautiful long black leather trench coats." Jagger joked that, "I thought to myself, if I have to learn to write songs to get one of those, I will." The two bands, which were pegged as being rivals in the rock press, were actually very close. John Lennon and Paul McCartney wrote the Stones' sophomore single, "I Want to Be Your Man." So let's close out today's program with the Beatles' plea to come together.
He wear no shoe shine, he got toe jam football, he got monkey finger, he shoot Coca-Cola, he say, "I know you, you know me. One thing I can tell you is you got to be free. Come together.
Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Music Review. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. This program is also available as a podcast after the broadcast in our website, ncreadingservice.org. As we leave you now, remember these words: kindness is the language which blind people see and deaf people hear. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. If you have a suggestion for music to feature on this program, please leave a message for me at 919-832-5138. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Music Review, underwritten by Bill McClure, tuning pianos in the Raleigh area since 1968. For more information or to schedule a piano tuning, please call 919-779-1755. So long, until next time.